powered through the Alaska Airlines Studios.
This is Jake and Stacy on 710 ESPN Seattle. Streaming live on the 710 Sports app and at 710sports.com.
Now, here are your hosts, Jake Heaps and Stacy Ross.
Want to win tickets to see the Seahawks host the Cardinals at Lumen Field on November 21st? Well, text the word Hawks. H-A-W-K-S. Guys, Hawks is plural. I saw a couple people yesterday texting Hawk. Make sure you text Hawks with an S to our new text line, 206-421-3776, to learn how. Contest ends this Monday at midnight, so text Hawks, H-A-W-K-S, to 206-421-3776 now for your chance to enter to win. Again, that number, 206-421-3776. It's the biggest offseason for the Mariners in 20 years. Why? Well, because they've got the best farm system they've had in years. They've got a skipper who was just nominated for AL Manager of the Year. Congrats to Scott Service. They've got one top prospect, Jared Kelnick, with the team, and another, Julio Rodriguez, on the verge of joining the team. And they've made it clear that they're willing to spend. Some of you guys, and including your girl, have your own doubts about whether or not they're really going to spend, how much they're going to spend. But they've made it clear they're going to be in on it. So what are they going to spend on? Jerry DePoto isn't going to be completely honest with us, right? Jerry DePoto isn't going to be like, here's the thing, guys, we're in on Marcus Semien. We're going to offer him this much. But he did take questions, at least, during an interview with MLB Network about the kind of guys they're going to target and where specifically they want to add. So let's start here. He talks about wanting to lengthen the lineup.
We want to add some impact, you know, make that lineup longer. While we showed promise with a lot of our players, you know, now we need to add some impact to that lineup and get longer. We feel like there's an opportunity to do that with an infield bat and what is a historically good infield free agent class.
Now, that means looking at those shortstops, though. He's made it clear that J.P. Crawford isn't going to be moved from shortstop. So I think that overrules a guy like Carlos Correa that's probably going to play at shortstop, though certainly keeps things open for a guy like Marcus Semien, who can play second base, and I think that's why he's been a popular target and pickup for Mariners fans. What do you guys hear there?
Well, what I hear and what makes me nervous, to be quite frank, is you did mention the fact that he's not going to let us in on everything that they're thinking.
I would love it if he did.
He also, yesterday, just to put it into context, yesterday he said that they're not going to really look at, you know, the center field market very seriously. And then John Morosi today tweets out how all-star center fielder Brian Reynolds is drawing significant interest in the trade market with the Yankees and Mariners among potential suitors. So, like, Jerry DePoto, they're looking into everything and every possibility, even when they say they're not. But and I don't want to, you know, just sit here and pinpoint one little word that he said and try to extrapolate it too much, but doesn't it make you nervous a little bit when he says infielder, not infielders, in a big bat and important? Is this an example of him trying to not overpromise and underdeliver here?
I would feel more concerned if it was we're looking to add a pitcher. I actually am the positions overall that I'm most comfortable with. Like, I was overall fine with the infield. I know they're losing Seager. And I know that they need a better second baseman because no offense to Toro, but he just was not consistent there. But overall, I felt most fine with the infield. And I think that you can field a good team just adding one position and then finding a way to fill in third or get a guy who can play both third and outfield, right? Like a guy like Chris Bryant or something.
Yeah.
But no, I was not as concerned with that, which is shocking. Normally, we would be kind of switched here.
Yeah, but I was. I mean, I think that when you're talking about this team and realistically what you're going to have to do to be able to get yourself in that situation again and to be able to get over the hump and to be able to get yourself into the playoffs and do damage when you're in the playoffs is you've got to be not just quote-unquote aggressive, but you've got to really be aggressive in the way that you're targeting this thing and how you're going about it. So is it really just simply they need to get an outfield bat, a fourth outfielder, and a big bat at second base and with Marcus Semien, and then they'll be okay with the rest of the crew that they have? I mean, personally, I hope that they're being way more aggressive than what Jerry DePoto is indicating here with that cut. That they are, obviously, we all know that they want Marcus Semien really, really badly. But I want to see them add impact as well at third base with Chris Bryant, Trevor Story, Javi Baez, Matt Chapman. I mean, all those names, you look at them, and the more I think about it, the more realistic I think any one of those names really could be for the Seattle Mariners. It's just a matter of exactly what do they envision the way that they spend and how much do they spend, how aggressive do they get in terms of rounding out that entire infield.
Can I throw in an extra question? And Curtis, you can chime in on here. We've had so many people asking what's happening at third with, is Toro going there? Is France going there? I think we can rule out Evan White going there.
Well, he's left-handed.
Exactly. So what do you guys think?
You can't have Evan White play third base because he's
so
left-handed.
So they're going to have Evan White working out a little bit in left field, but I think the most popular thing I see is, what about Toro at third, or what about moving Ty France to third, Evan White at first?
I don't think Evan White at first is even a possibility at this point. Ty France showed he was, by all the metrics, that he was the best fielding first baseman in baseball. In addition to having a really consistent bat, he hit near 300 at the end of the season. He's your first baseman going into 2022. Third base remains very unclear. I don't think Abraham Toro is an everyday third baseman or really an everyday second baseman at this point. I think there is a need at third base, just as there's a need at second base, because like I said, Toro's not an everyday second baseman either. Going back to the quote from Jerry DePoto where he says, you know, an infielder, maybe that means they're looking to sign just one in free agency and maybe address another position via a trade. Now, I would be okay with that, whether it be Matt Chapman, Jose Ramirez from Cleveland. You're obviously going to have to give up a lot more for Jose Ramirez than you would for Matt Chapman.
Yeah. Yes.
But I don't think the Mariners can limit themselves by putting all their eggs in the basket for Marcus Semien, because let's say Semien doesn't sign in Seattle. Well, now who do you go after? Maybe Javi Baez, somebody like that.
Yeah.
But it leaves you with a lot less wiggle room to get by here.
I want to get back to all the other quotes that Jerry said. I want to throw in one final question, though, because the biggest debate I've seen following Jerry DePoto's talk with Mike Salk, actually, on the Jerry DePoto show, where he made it clear, we're not moving on from JP at shortstop. And he made that clear in his press conference with reporters, too. Do you guys think that's a mistake? Do you think it's a mistake to look past Carlos Correa, who's the top free agent in this market, and say, no, we want JP at shortstop, so we're going to go elsewhere?
No, I don't, because I also think that you have to make the assessment early on, and maybe they feel like, hey, we talked to Carlos Correa's people, and they're not interested in the Mariners. Maybe they've already given that early indication, and we don't know that, right? So I just never really felt like Carlos Correa would want to go to the Mariners over some other teams that I think have a higher profile. I mean, if you're Carlos Correa, you're taking a big risk in trusting an organization like the Mariners versus going to an organization like the Yankees, going to an organization, you know, like the Red Sox or any of these other blue-blooded programs. And I hate saying that, but that is the uphill battle that you're against. And if you're Carlos Correa, here's your opportunity, here's your moment to not only get a big-time payday, but to continue to be recognized on a year-in, year-out basis as one of the best players in baseball. I think that Carlos Correa, just to me, it just strikes me he's a guy that wants a little bit more than settling here for the Seattle Mariners, even though if he was here, you could create something special.
All right, Jerry, where else do you want to add? Here's what he said.
We also want to see if we can just make the back half of our lineup a little bit longer, and that may come in the form of some type of roll bat or even adding to our outfield to join Kalou and Kelnick and Haniger in the early going. And that may be in the form of trade. It may be in the form of the free agent market.
Am I backwards by thinking I would rather some of the guys you have now transition to utility guys in the back half of your lineup and instead to improve the top part of your lineup? You know what I mean? Like, add real impact bats, and then inevitably a guy like Toro becomes a utility guy? No?
Yeah,
Am I wrong for thinking that?
No, I mean, I could definitely see that. And, you know, I think that that's one of the unique aspects about Toro, you know, just in general in terms of his potential flexibility. But I still think that there are a lot of good players out there that you can go out and get, like a Mark Canha, who make a ton of sense in terms of what Jerry DePoto was talking about in terms of lengthening that back half of the lineup up for your team, where he is versatile, but also is a proven veteran bat. And I think that that is something that you have to consider, and probably you're looking at Kyle Schwarber, who came into your own T-Mobile Park and made it a lot harder on you in the last month of the season to get to the playoffs, because he came up big in that three-game series. So Mark Canha is a guy that makes a ton of sense there, and I still believe that they will be aggressive with guys like Seiya Suzuki and all that. But is there anybody, I would just want to throw this out there, is there anybody from an outfield perspective that you would be good with them going after aggressively versus somebody like a Marcus Semien or Curtis, you threw out the Jose Ramirez trade. Is there anybody else that you would be fine from an outfield perspective going out there being aggressive in the trade market?
I mean, Chris Bryant, again, it's because of his versatility.
He has availability in the outfield, yeah.
Yeah. That because you could swap for third base and outfield, I think it makes sense. It's hard because I'm okay with the corner outfield, and my assumption is just, well, Julio is going to be your center fielder, because we've heard from Shannon that they're using him way more in center field in the minors, and I think the assumption is like he's got a chance to break camp with the team and could at least be up there a bit later. Like, I feel like the Mariners are planning on Julio being that guy. So I don't know how much they want to spend to bring in someone now. But
Jake, I'll give you a name. And it's a name that I think you've brought up a couple of times in the last, 2 months since the season ended. And that's Starling Marte, former A's outfielder, Marlins outfielder, who is not somebody that's going to hit 40 home runs or anything like that, but he is going to put the ball in play. He was among the league leaders in batting average last year and also led the league in stolen bases. He's 33 years old, so I don't think you would sign him for more than maybe 3 or 4 years, but is a dynamic outfielder and is somebody that you could put out there every single day and would be, he's a center fielder too, which is what this team needs. I don't think you can say that Jared Kelnick is a center fielder, is naturally a center fielder, just as I don't think you can say Julio Rodriguez is naturally a center fielder, and I don't think you can say Mitch Haniger is that either. You don't have somebody right now that can play center field on a reliable, reliably. Starling Marte is that kind of guy in the outfield.
Yeah, that's where the unique aspect of this whole thing comes together. And another name that has been linked, that Jerry DePoto mentioned himself in terms of guys that fit the profile of what the Mariners like to be at the plate. Michael Conforto, did I just butcher that name, Conforto?
You got it.
Yeah, there we go. From the Mets. He's another guy that is intriguing when you talk about the Mark Canhas and all that. I think Michael Conforto has more upside from that perspective in terms of, what he's able to do, but that's another guy. But is Conforto is a corner outfielder, right, Curtis?
Yeah, he's a right fielder.
So, maybe this year you try to just piecemeal this whole thing together from an outfield perspective. You're more focused on the bats and what they can bring to you, looking at a Mark Canha, looking at a Conforto, looking at Kelnick, looking at Mitch Haniger, Julio Rodriguez, Kyle Lewis. All these guys have the ability to, really hit. And maybe they're prioritizing that over defense this season in the outfield, and we'll see if that ends up working for them.
All right, let's get to four down territory.
This is four down territory, brought to you by Genuine Auto Glass. Going inside the game with quarterback guru Jake Heaps.
Jake Heaps played in the NFL, played quarterback, was in the room with him, was in the fire. He's really a guru. He really played the game.
First down, Jake, super easy question. How do you slow down Aaron Rodgers?
Oh, yes, the easiest question of all.
Something the rest of the league has figured out.
I got the key and the answer for you. It is to be able to consistently get in the face and disrupt and pressure Aaron Rodgers. Now, that is a lot easier said than done. And the reason why it's a lot easier said than done is because, one, the Green Bay Packers have a very good offensive line. Two, they have a very balanced attack. They protect Aaron Rodgers with the running game. They do a good job with that. And third, Aaron Rodgers is incredibly smart. He does a great job of getting the ball out of his hands quickly. When he sees pressure, when he sees problem situations, he flips that ball out into the flat, into the bubble screens, the now screens, all those things that you see, these receiver perimeter screens that make it extremely hard to get to Aaron Rodgers. But in the rare chances when teams have been able to do it, Aaron Rodgers quickly looks mortal. Aaron Rodgers, we have seen him look very, very average at best when he is consistently pressured, when you are able to collapse that pocket around him and suffocate that pocket around him. Aaron Rodgers, he really struggles in those situations. But the hard part, Stacey, is that, one, it's difficult to do, and two, the Seattle Seahawks have not been consistent in that area defensively. So that is the one way that you slow down Aaron Rodgers, and to me, that's going to be an incredible task for the Seattle Seahawks defense, because it's something that they have not specialized in this season.
Second down. All right, now there's a slim chance, but a possible chance, that Aaron Rodgers isn't able to go. He remains on the COVID list, eligible to come back on Saturday, the day before. So what should we expect from the Green Bay offense if he isn't out there?
Well, I'll tell you my thoughts in a second, but I loved hearing Bobby Wagner's thoughts on this here in cut number 9.
He's a guy that has the whole playbook opened up, and you know, a lot of the times he can come to the line, and you know, he can look at a defense and change the play based off of what he sees. And so with a younger quarterback, you're not going to get that. So kind of what you see is what you're going to get. It's very rare that a young quarterback is coming up to the line of scrimmage, identifying what coverage we're in, and changing the play. And even if he does it, it's very basic. It's not, you know, if he sees a certain coverage that, you know, maybe see an 8-man box or 7-man box, check to a pass or a run. It's very basic. But with, you know, Aaron Rodgers, he can see a certain safety come down and check and run directly to that.
So, long story short, as Bobby's talking about, all the different things that Aaron Rodgers can do constantly, as I've been saying over and over and over again that the Seattle Seahawks offense should be doing, Aaron Rodgers constantly is putting this offense in a good spot and is allowed to do so. Run, pass, however you talk about it. You know, Jordan Love is going to be very limited. They are not going to allow him to have that freedom at the line of scrimmage. And if they go up there with a, you know, check with me, meaning that he can change the play, as Bobby Wagner talked about, it's very basic and it's not a dagger type of moment where they are going to gash you in the run game. They're going to gash you with this passing play that Aaron Rodgers can get to. So if they face Jordan Love, they are going to face a very watered down, vanilla version of the Green Bay Packers offense. And Jordan Love is capable. He's talented. He can make big throws. But in terms of his confidence and the way that he sees the field, Stacey, against a horrific Kansas City Chiefs defense, Jordan Love was very underwhelming. And so if Jordan Love is the quarterback for the Green Bay Packers, that is a very, very, very much a positive thing for the Seattle Seahawks.
I'm going to say something that should not be controversial, but for some reason is. Vanilla is a pretty good flavor.
It's a great flavor.
It gets a bad rep. You know
it's
what
versatile.
I mean? A lot of people talk about vanilla, and I get it. Like, it's
very
basic.
Versatile.
It's just there. There's not added flavors. And vanilla is the flavor of ice cream or whatever that's always available. And you want something exciting. You want to be like, throw cookies and pretzels and brownies in it. You know what I mean? Charge me an extra $5. I don't even care. But vanilla itself, pretty decent. Like, pretty solid.
It's a solid flavor. But in terms of on the football field, vanilla...
That's
fantastic for this defense in regards to the challenge that they would have facing Aaron Rodgers.
See, I think we need to change it. I think the insult needs to be like a bad offense is like a strawberry ice cream offense. Strawberry ice cream is disgusting. I digress.
Ice cream, I'm on board with you. Strawberry milk, different discussion.
Third down. Strawberry milk's gross too. Third down, Jake. What Green Bay Packers defensive players should the Seahawks pay attention to? Outside of all of them. But, like, what ones especially?
Well, I'm going to give you three, and two of them, because these guys are really good players, and one because I think this is a player that the Seahawks should absolutely be attacking. The first two, defensive tackle number 97, Kenny Clark, is their very best defensive player. He is underrated as underrated gets, but in the middle of that defense, he is a monster, absolute beast. And right now, he did suffer an injury in the last game in the second half. He did not play in the second half of last week's game, but it does look like he is going to play in this one. So that is my guy to keep an eye on, especially when you talk about the interior of this offensive line, Stacey, for the Seahawks, the center position. Damian Lewis, Gabe Jackson, they are going to have their hands full with number 97, Kenny Clark. The other name, edge rusher, number 52, Rashawn Gary, with Za'Darius Smith being out, with Preston Smith being in and out of the lineup. Rashawn Gary, former first-round pick, the same draft class as LJ Collier, by the way, went a few picks earlier. This guy has been an absolute beast on the edge. He is going to be the main pass rusher trying to get after Russell Wilson's had a fantastic year. And then the guy that they have to attack, cornerback number 21, Eric Stokes. He's a rookie. He's playing because Jaire Alexander has been out on IR. And if Eric Stokes is playing, that's the guy that they should be constantly trying to attack with Tyler Lockett, DK Metcalf. And if Eric Stokes is not able to play because he had some injury issues as well in last week's game, all the better, because their depth there at cornerback is razor thin. So that is an area for the Seattle Seahawks that they should be exploiting.
It's too bad they can't play Daniel Sorensen. Like, it'd be nice to be able to play the Chiefs defense every week. You know what I mean?
Why are you attacking Daniel Sorensen?
Because it's fun. Because it's a cool thing to do right now.
Teammate of mine at BYU.
Listen to me. There is currently someone launching a GoFundMe in order to buy out his contract. Do I think that's mean? Yes. Do I also think it's kind of funny? Yes. Both things can be true. I both feel bad for him and am laughing at this.
Special teams captain that is forced to play.
Shout out Daniel Sorensen. Fourth down. All right. We had first down, second down, third down, where we learned about specific aspects of this game. So now what's the key to success for the Seahawks in the run game?
Well, the key to success in the running game is be diverse, a diverse running game. Jake, what does that mean? I can hear you asking that question.
Stacey, I didn't ask but I thought it.
Let me tell you. What it means is you have to change the personnel groupings. You have to change the formation. You have to be able to change the picture pre-snap motion at the line of scrimmage. You have to get out and spread formations and run the football. You have to do it in a variety of different ways. And I do not want to see, the Seattle Seahawks line up in 12 personnel and try to run the football down the Green Bay Packers' throat to start this game. I'd rather see them get into spread formations, do what they do really well, which is those gun runs plays to start things up, and then they can get into a bunch of different other looks. But to me, it's got to be because the running game is diverse, not because they're just lining it up old school and running it down your throat. So that, to me, is going to be the big key for the Seahawks in order to have a successful running game, even with Chris Carson coming back into the lineup.
Don't forget, you can watch the show live on 710sports.com/video. Coming up next in the timeline, I get it. If the Mariners lineup, parts of the offense are being overlooked by the rest of MLB. What I don't understand is the egregious error that MLB made the other day. That's next.
This is The Timeline
with Jake and Stacey.
Brought to you by 1-800-DUIOA.
It's The Timeline on Jake and Stacey. That's when we look around the world of sports, reading it right off my Twitter account to see the biggest trends that we're all watching for. So let's start with this one. Jim Mora has been hired as the next head football coach at UConn. Why am I reading it off the timeline? Well, not only is it the biggest story, but shout out to Curtis at A Kid from Kent, and shout out to Brock Heward for their subtle dig at Jim Mora, tweeting, "Jim Mora, finally a Husky head coach."
He did it.
Lived out his dream. Finally. I don't know about you guys, but this was the oddest hire I had seen in quite some time. One, because Jim Mora, I mean, his ending with UCLA was not the best, first and foremost. And the second is, Jim Mora is a West Coast guy. and he is getting hired all the way on the East Coast to UConn? Like, how is that going to turn out? How is that going to be successful with Jim Mora on the recruiting trail?
But the UConn program, I believe, is also, like, on their way to either moving down a step, like, to the FCS level, or they've kind of thought about folding it, too. So
yes,
this is kind of a last-ditch effort on their part to get some kind of respectability. Jim Mora does not strike me as a program builder in that way.
Yeah, I just don't see it. I don't see it either. I don't know. Maybe his personality will do better on the East Coast. I have no idea, but I just don't see this being a very positive trend. But guess what? As you've talked about, you know, Jim Mora's career, he has had some pretty nice paydays, and this is time now for him. He stopped getting paid from UCLA, so you got to get back out there. Got to get get that next contract with UConn, and we'll see how that goes. But think about this. His last two coaching stops, Stacey, with the Seahawks, he gets fired after a year, still gets paid the three remaining years of that salary. He goes to UCLA. I think he had 4 years left on that contract with UCLA and gets paid that money. I mean, sometimes when you're a top-tier head coach and you get that big contract, you get fired, it's not all bad.
Question for you guys. Who are the Ryan Fitzpatricks of coaching? Guys where like you're like, oh, he is coaching them now. And they always kind of bounce around and they're always there, but they're never really like the main guy or the best guy.
Bobby Petrino's like that.
I was going to say Kiffin, yeah. Lane Kiffin.
Oh, Lane Kiffin, yeah.
He's like a Fitzpatrick.
Where you just kind of like wait a couple of years and they're bound to pop up somewhere.
That's exactly right.
For a couple times, it was Charlie Weiss as well.
Yeah.
And I was there with his last head coaching stop. You know, so that was a unique deal as well. But you're right. I mean, a lot of these guys, sometimes they just off of name brand value alone, you find some university out there that's willing to take that shot.
Charlie Weiss, by the way, Shane Waldron came up under him with the Patriots and then later at Notre Dame.
Yes, he did follow them over there. I have yet to talk to Shane Waldron about that, but I'm sure there are some tremendous stories. Oh, guaranteed tremendous stories.
Or as I said as a child, Notre Dame, because I didn't know the difference.
Like the Hunchback?
Yes. I didn't know, and I kept saying Notre Dame, and people would be like, what?
Hey, that's an honest mistake. It's the same spelling.
I like to think so. All right. Next story here. If you are seeing Paul Sewald trending, well, he had a response after he was not nominated to the 2021 All-MLB team as a reliever. So let me first get to a response from one of our own, producer Mike Lefko of Wyman and Bob. So he retweets MLB Network's relief pitchers that are nominated for All-MLB honors. So they've got the starting pitchers, which fair that no Mariners are included there. I get it, even though you can make a case for Chris Flexen. But the relief pitchers are really where you kind of scratch your head because you've got guys in here, Aroldis Chapman, who were not fantastic and who Paul Sewald especially, but you could make a case for, I don't know, maybe Casey Sadler, but certainly Sewald had a better season than him.
Maybe
so,
Casey Sadler? Absolutely Mike, Casey Sadler.
Young
what
Michael Lefko.
What is up with the disrespect, Stacey?
Young Michael
Classic
Lefko.
Classic East Coast bias.
Says a 2.1 war, active streak of 29 straight appearances without allowing a run. And he's in and Sadler isn't on this. He was very confused. And of course, Sewald, also a big one here. And Sewald, he did what we call a subtweet, which is just where you say, okay, with some eyeball emojis, just a little confused here, looking around, wondering what the heck is going on.
So, I love it.
Yeah, he did a little thinking man emoji, which I took as rightfully being a little confused as to why he and some teammates weren't on there when the Mariners had one of the best bullpens all season long from wire to wire.
I want Paul Sewald, I want Casey Sadler, I want the entire bullpen to go full-on Richard Sherman, Twitter war, posting and blasting this list and showing in comparison statistically how they are better than a lot of these guys that are on this list. That's what I want. Go after him. Sewald, Steckenrider, Sadler, let's go. Don't sit back and be passive about this. Let's show these guys up. All right, classic, Curtis, you said it, classic East Coast bias. Oh, man, it is It's disgusting.
Yeah, what's Aroldis Chapman doing on this?
No,
list?
Literally, I am wondering the same. Does I'm not even saying that to be a
doesn't belong.
No,
but he's a Yankee. He's a Yankee.
No, that is what it is, and it's not even like the Yankees were a fantastic team. You still got beat by the Red Sox. You know what I mean? Like, you didn't. It's not like you were a World Series team, and so hey, you went far, and we're looking at all of this. But I don't understand why no Mariners relievers were included. I genuinely don't. Like, there are times in baseball especially where people on the East Coast probably get so tired of people on the West Coast calling out East Coast bias, but it is real. It is real, and I feel that's especially the case in baseball.
You know what's nuts about Paul Sewald's season that I don't think we talk about enough is that he finished second on the Mariners in saves and second on the team in wins. That's absurd.
It's just ridiculous.
Second in saves and second in wins.
He's no Chapman,
this
though.
Guy stinks, though, Curtis. He is not. Paul Sewald is not worthy of being on this list with these, you know, blessed East Coast blue-blooded program type of pitchers. He is not good enough to grace this list. So, you know, I mean, just a clear shot and disrespect to the Mariners. And you know what? Us classic Northwesterners, we are all in on this because we feel the disrespect daily. Daily!
All right. That will do it for the timeline today. Shout out to the Mariners bullpen, to Sewald and Sadler for phenomenal work. You get our props, even though you weren't recognized by the MLB.
You're our pitchers of the
you're
year.
You're our MLB all-stars.
You are. In our hearts.
This hour of Jake and Stacey is brought to you by Muckleshoot Casino. As a reminder, you guys, short show, short Jake and Stacey today, though Jake and myself and Curtis will stick around, and we'll bring on Dave Wyman for the huddle. We've got Freddie Swain. Curtis is thinking about it. We've got Freddie Swain joining us, Al Woods joining us, and a ton of great insight from a couple of analysts. That's all starting at noon with a two-hour preview. Before that, I have a complaint. I have a complaint I'd like to make. That's next.
You're listening to Jake and Stacey.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studios.
Streaming live on the 710 Sports app and at 710sports.com.
Now, here are your hosts, Jake Heaps and Stacey Rost.
This hour of Jake and Stacey is brought to you by Muckleshoot Casino. Don't forget, you can listen to us on the go or catch up with the show if you miss it. Subscribe to the Jake and Stacey podcast. It's on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, 710sports.com/podcast, wherever you get your podcast. Please don't forget to rate and review if you do subscribe. Thank you in advance from the two of us. As a reminder, we are jumping into a two-hour preview show next. Dave Wyman is going to join us for the huddle, world-famous huddle. So we're wrapping it up here, and normally in our shows we do a question segment where we take your questions, but instead I wanted to end with – I'm not going to call it a complaint. I'm going to say just like a final thought. And this is a broader one on sports media and sports coverage in general. And this has to do with Adam Schefter. And I should preface it by saying this isn't a complaint about Adam Schefter, the person, nor about the work that Adam Schefter does. He is an incredibly trusted source in particularly NFL media, but in sports media as a whole. His stuff is almost always right. He's incredibly well connected. Usually, like many of you, I kind of wait until Adam Schefter says something, and when I see Adam Schefter say it, I just assume that is correct. But in some ways, that can backfire. And that kind of exemplifies a bigger problem with sports media in general. And I was having a fascinating conversation about this with another colleague, Michael Sean Dugar, who talked about this himself, but I'm going to kind of roll with it for this specific example. So here's what happened. Adam Schefter right now is under fire for a tweet that he had about Dalvin Cook. And it got us thinking about oversights with sports media. So I want to be clear that when I tell you about this, I'm not passing judgment on either Cook or the woman involved in this case. So I'm not passing judgment on who's the perpetrator or who's the victim, rather on how the entire thing was reported. So Adam Schefter reported, quote, that Cook had been the victim of domestic abuse and an extortion plot. And he threw on that, yes, that's according to his agent. But he wrote about it in a way that caused a lot of people to kind of turn and stare at each other and just go, what? I'm sorry. Dalvin Cook is the victim of domestic abuse and extortion. And I'm going to tell you guys that when I first read that tweet, my reaction was to interpret it strictly as fact. And the only thing I was wondering is, where's the rest of the information? It feels a little irresponsible to put out this tweet without any other context, without any other information. But immediately I was thinking, God, Dalvin Cook, man, I'm so, you know, interested to see what he says about this. And, you know, abuse happens to men and women and all kinds of people. And so those were the conversations that I was immediately having. But where it went, obviously, was that the Star Tribune, which is a Minnesota-based newspaper, they got more information about the entire thing. And in reality, the entire situation looks a lot more gray. Both Dalvin and a woman are making accusations about the other. And so, in my opinion, what Adam Schefter should have done as a responsible journalist is make clear that, hey, Dalvin Cook is alleging this. Another person is alleging this. Here's what's happening with Dalvin Cook, rather than to present it as fact. And it's such a small thing. It is such a small correction. But what's important is that it doesn't state anything as fact because we don't have the facts yet, right? Mm-hmm. And I just think that that's how you do responsible journalism. And I think sometimes what happens in journalism, in media, but especially with sports journalism, is it's about being first. I've done this a million times. And it's not about whether Adam Schefter considers himself a pure journalist. It's about whether readers and sports fans do. And for the most part, they do. And so when people see you as an arbiter of truth and see you as someone that knows the facts and you don't present something as maybe not being a fact, then you're going to change the narrative for a pretty serious case. And so my kind of like complaint, my final thought that I'm lodging here, Jake, is just that I wish that influential reporters and nugget gatherers and insiders in sports media would just be really careful when they're reporting and keep in mind that they have so much influence, far more so than any local reporters.
Well, this gets into a topic that gets really deep in every aspect of journalism in every single field, whether it's political, whether it's sports. But in this regard of Adam Schefter in particular, I mean, it is, as you said, a small change of the framing of the way that this was said, and you're not having this conversation. But the problem is, and this is another problem that it goes towards Adam Schefter and kind of what he was getting burned with from the whole Washington football emails that came about, that Adam Schefter was letting Bruce Allen look at what he was going to put out there before he ended up doing it, right? To me, this is another example of Adam Schefter kind of doing that for a sports agent, for a NFL prominent client, and speaking up on their behalf, mm-hmm. rather than saying, hey, this is something that was given to me, information about this, and I know that there's both sides of the case, here's what they're saying. And to your point, it changes and frames the conversation from the beginning, from the jump, and instead of getting to the heart of the truth, or at least being honest about what he's putting out there, right? And that, to me, is something that is disturbing. It's something that has to be changed and has to be corrected. And as you mentioned with Adam Schefter, Stacey, you 100% nailed it. I was just shaking my head along with everything that you were saying, because it is vital. It is important. And it's not you getting up on your soapbox and saying, you know, look at me and this is what I think. It is an important aspect of the job that we do. We as radio hosts, we give our opinion. We try to give the news the best way possible. But when it comes to sports journalists, we also rely on them as well in terms of their reporting, in terms of what they're putting out there, so that we can convey and shape our opinions to give to the audience as well. And our opinions could have been drastically shaped based off of that one report from Adam Schefter, right? And that, to me, bothers me, because we want to give our best opinion, mm-hmm. of the actual truth and facts, rather than the spin being portrayed as truth.
Yeah. And I think that even journalists who try hard to tell the truth can always make mistakes. Like, no one can be perfect. There are human flaws, because we're all people that grow up with unique perspectives, and there's always going to be a perspective, no matter how hard you try to be unbiased in what you're reporting. And so I don't think that people can be free of mistakes. Like, I genuinely think most people try to do the right thing. Most people care about presenting the right information, most especially if they make their lives presenting and curating information. But yeah, it's just one of those things where I remind myself of it. And it's just a reminder to, as people who consume sports media and as people who distribute sports media, to just slow down. And sometimes with these stories, especially in sports radio, we want to jump into it. We want to debate. We want to talk about it. Like, we're talkers, right? And everyone listening right now, they're listening because they're talkers and they talk with their friends about it. And you have discussions with your friends. But sometimes I just want to remember to slow down for a minute when it comes to really important things like this. So anyways, that is my final thought from our show today. And now we're going to jump into, we're going to take a fun turn. We're going to look at a 2-hour preview of the Seahawks game against the Packers. Dave Wyman is going to join us. We're going to have Freddie Swain, Al Woods, all kinds of good stuff. It is all coming your way next on The Huddle.